Gutflix is the streaming platform for digestive health professionals. Discover curated GI content on IBD, hepatology, endoscopy, and more, as well as expert courses, UEG Week recordings, and podcasts personalized to your clinical interests. Start exploring at gutflix.eu. Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this new episode of the UEG Podcast. It's Pradeep Mundra here, gastroenterologist from the UK and podcast host for UEG, an amazing organization doing so much for education within the European gastroenterology. Now, I recently covered celiac disease with Professor David Sanders. That was released a few weeks ago, and I would strongly urge the listeners to listen to that episode before coming on to this one. In that episode, mainly we discussed about diagnosis of celiac disease, and he does mention the only treatment for celiac disease is gluten-free diet, although there are new drugs in development, in research, but none of them are ready for prime time use. Although we discussed quite a lot on various aspects, we did not discuss about gluten-free diet, how to advise our patients. And in my own practice, I feel my own knowledge, and especially knowledge of gluten-free diet amongst clinicians, is limited. And we rely heavily on referral to dietetic services or dietitians who would predominantly give this advice to the patients. Especially when I see my patients, I see them, I say, oh, Mr. Smith, you've got this diagnosis of celiac disease, you need to go on gluten-free diet. And I'll give a 10-second advice. Yeah, Google search or go to this website, and then that's about it. But luckily, I have wonderful celiac dietitian service led by Christian I would rely on, and it's easy for me. However, I don't think so. All of us across Europe have access to a specialist celiac disease dietitian for their patients. And overall, because a lot of these patients are managed still by gastroenterologists, I think it's very important that we as clinicians know about the dietary aspects of celiac disease, which we often, I feel, we get it wrong. So today to talk about this, we have Christian Kostas, who is a celiac specialist dietitian running the dietitian-led celiac service at Bradford Teaching Hospitals in the UK. He's a multi-award-winning dietitian. He's also a co-author of the latest iteration of the British Society Celiac Guidelines that are due to be published soon. More importantly, Christian, what I appreciate is your dedication to education in all matters of celiac disease. You have produced some amazing online content, and you have a huge presence online with your Instagram page. If people want to check it out, I'm sure Christian will tell that it's a celiac underscore dietitian. He has a huge presence with more than 20,000 followers online. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Pradeep. Thank you for having me. And thanks to the UEG for, you know, the fantastic platform they've got. It's a true honor to be here to speak about such a special subject.
Excellent. Okay. Christian, let's start off with the, I mentioned about the dietitian-led celiac clinic that you run. Could you mention what that is and how did you set this up maybe? And if there are any other clinicians out there who want to set this service up along with their dietetics colleagues, how could they go about in brief?
Brilliant. That's a great question. So the dietitian-led celiac service is something that's been kind of growing in the UK, I'd say, over the last 20 years. So we're definitely not the first ones to have it, but we've given it a lot of momentum. So really what it is, it's a model that sort of flips the historic model on its head, right? So rather than having the traditional gastroenterologist sees the patient from diagnosis to ongoing follow-up and then maybe refers to the dietitian at the start, and the patient might get like one or two appointments and then they kind of get left to figure things out a bit more, or we assume that everything's fine. It turns out around and after diagnosis, then the patient sees a dietitian. The dietitian kind of takes care of the patient's care and then refers back to gastroenterology when needed. And what we've got in Bradford, we've sort of established that with some extended roles where we've got some agreed bloods that I myself as a dietitian and our other dietitian can take. And we've got a bit of an agreed pathway. But the good thing about that is that the patient gets structured support from diagnosis to ongoing follow-up. And that helps us to make sure that everything is Dave Sanders was saying, you know, the diet's the cornerstone of treatment. So we really make sure that patients get the right support from the start. They get that, but if there's medical issues, there's a quick access, and we've got that, you know, team working with gastroenterologists to explore issues, explore things further if needed. So it gets the best of both worlds. And what we've shown is that it's also a cost-effective way of doing things. It can save gastroenterologist appointments and necessary investigations. Patients have improved confidence too, and we've published some data around this. So it's all, I think it's a win-win for everybody, really, if done in the right way. So I would say if people want to set it up, you know, we advise a lot of people on some of the things that can be done. But I think a good conversation about how it can run to make sure it's safe, effective, and that there's good teamwork in between gastroenterologist and dietitian, I think that's key. But we're always happy to help out. If anyone's got any questions or wants any data that we've got, we're always happy to share it.
Yeah, that's a good way to go, Christian. I think most of the patients wait a long time to see a gastroenterologist, and the disease area where we tend to sort of ignore, or at least not, you know, a lot of us don't have the latest up-to-date knowledge on these things. And somebody who has a special interest in this would run it much better way than patients getting mixed up with various other disease conditions. Generally, gastroenterologists see celiac disease as a very benign disease, whereas patient side, they suffer quite a lot. And that's where the importance is, I think.
For sure.
So, Christian, let's move on. Let's say we've made a new diagnosis of celiac disease, and I send a referral to you to see the patients. This is the first time you see those patients. They don't have any knowledge on what a gluten-free diet is. What's your approach to such patients? What sort of advice would you give?
Brilliant. I think it's a great question. It's really common to see. So I'd say to start off, I think it's really important to highlight that, yes, time will be limited in a lot of these consultations. There's only so much you can do, right, with the knowledge and training that you have in the time. So I would say the first thing is, if you don't have access to a dietitian, right, I think it's really about signposting to the best sources of information there. And I would say, first off, for example, I'd say rather than saying to the patient, right, if you go on Google, if we've got some trusted sources, that's a really good first step, right? That's the best one, right? Because what happens is I see a lot with patients and they'll go on Google, some will find good sources, some others, and they get really confused, right? So say in the UK, for example, we've got Celiac UK, the charity supports people with celiac disease, but the Celiac Societies internationally, that's what I'd say, whatever country you're in, try to get them to go to the Celiac Society. They can also join the Celiac Society potentially, and there's some good resources for foods they can find. They can also connect with people with, there's some support groups that are sometimes structured so they can connect with other people. This is a really important thing in celiac disease because people feel very isolated. So if they connect with other people, they can get advice, support that helps them from the onset. So again, that's something that, you know, if you just that signposting can make a big difference. But I'd also say an important thing to say, even if you say, let's say you've got 5 minutes, right? A really important thing is, although, as you were saying, Pradeep, you've got so many conditions to deal with and celiac disease isn't going to be the most severe. But what I'd say is those 5 minutes can be life-changing for that patient, right? Because they'll come to clinic with the expectation, I've got a diagnosis, what's my treatment, right? So I think that actually saying to them there, you know, this is a important condition because it's a multi-system autoimmune condition. As Prof. Sanders was saying, it can affect different areas of the body. And the only treatment is diet, but the diet has to be done really well, right? And I would say, even if you don't have the advice, a really quick thing, we'll talk about it later potentially, but what I'd say is you get them to touch your eyebrow. This is what they need to avoid in the gluten-free diet. It's an acronym, BROW, B-R-O-W, right? So you've got barley, rye, oats, and wheat. So at least you're telling them the main grains that they need to look out for, right? And then oats we'll talk about later a bit, but at least you can say, right, you know, remember that BROW, barley, rye, oats, and wheat. If you've got like 5 minutes, that's all. Signpost them, but also tell them that it's an important condition. And actually, you know, even if you don't have access to a dietitian there that you can send them to, at least tell the patient, this is an important diet. Try to seek really good information. If you can get any support out there from someone who's got specialist knowledge in the diet, great. But even if you can't, these are some good starting points there. And at least there in the same 5 minutes, it's the concept around the importance of the diet for that patient, and that really it's not an easy thing to do, because what I'd say is this diet is much more complicated than most of the treatments for the patient, what it entails, right? The restriction, the challenges. So it's good to highlight. And then in those 5 minutes, at least it's a good start. You're giving them a good head start with it.
Yeah, it's definitely not a simple prescription I can write. But if you see such patients, Christian, how in-depth do you go explaining them these? So maybe you can explain briefly about that.
Sure. Yeah, great question. So what I'd say is with them, what we tend to do is two steps. So the first one is really explaining the diagnosis in a bit more detail if that's needed. So some of them will have had that from their gastroenterologist doctor, but time's limited to some of them will have some questions. So I think that it's the why behind everything. Why do you need to follow such a restrictive diet, right? Because we're asking someone to restrict gluten for life. So they have to do it for a good reason. So I think that's the first connecting point for the patient. The patient needs to understand why is how it affects their condition, and everyone's got different symptoms. So they need to connect, make those connections. So we try to connect those dots first. Second is then tell them about the restriction. And what I'd say is to summarize it really quickly, it's, you know, gluten is a problem when you eat it, right? And that, and where, if you think of where you're going to eat gluten, so you're going to eat it with when you buy something with a food label, when you're at home, or when you're eating food from outside of the house. So we kind of go through those three scenarios and talk about labeling. We'll bring up this BRAO acronym, barley, rye, oats, and wheat. We'll talk about oats. Hopefully, you know, we've got a bit of time. We can talk about oats in a bit more detail later, right? But it's these things that, that we avoid, right? And then what we'll talk about, right, this is what you need to consider with food labels, what you have to do at home, making sure people at home are aware, because there's this whole thing around cross-contamination or cross-contact of gluten. It's not just the ingredients, how foods are cooked and prepared. Same with the food labels. And then when you eat out, what sort of things you have to do, what questions you have to ask, what you need to check when you go out to a restaurant. So as you can see, it impacts things, you know, and patients then will ask you about stuff like traveling, going to weddings, all these things you might not think of, but it impacts patients day to day. So we try to give them the whole, this is what you need to restrict, and this is what you need to include into your diet, because we also need to focus on what they need to eat. But I guess in a nutshell, hopefully if that gives a bit of context, and then that helps them to understand, right, it's this gluten-free diet I need to do, but now this is how I need to apply it in my life. And that's why I would say, although we talk about gluten-free diet as one, there's not one gluten-free diet, because the way we apply it with each patient is different. And it's a bit more personalized. Each person's scenario, situation is going to be different at work, you know, at home, all of that sort of stuff.
Okay, thanks, Christian, for explaining that. I guess the most common scenario I come across or that I face as a clinician is about dietary ingestion prior to diagnostic testing. So there are two scenarios here. The patient goes to primary physician or even a secondary care with some abdominal symptoms. We run a screening test such as a TTG. Or patients have already had that TTG done in the primary care. They're positive, and they waited 5 months to see a gastroenterologist. In that time, they have kind of said, oh, yeah, no, I have celiac disease. I'll restrict gluten in the diet, and they've come to see the gastroenterologist, and the gastroenterologist are trying to say, let's do a D2 biopsies. When we do diagnostic testing, what should be the dietary intake or gluten challenge, so to say? What's your advice? How would you give that advice to the patients?
Yeah, another really good one, a very common one, right? So I think that this is a tricky area too. There's a lot more layers than we initially think. So a lot of times we might say like normal diet, but then you break that down. So what does normal diet mean? Or even we say gluten-containing diet. So we've got to define it even further. And what we'd say is a lot from, you know, been working on this, on the guidelines to bring, you know, look at all the recent data and give more specifics to clinicians really. And I'd say that when it comes to the gluten challenge, there's probably like four key areas that we want to look at, right? So the first one is the type, right? So the type of gluten that we give. So a lot of times we say a gluten challenge, but we're telling a patient to eat bread. Well, we know that bread will have gluten, but it's also got some fructans, some FODMAPs in it, right? So there's other things that can trigger digestive symptoms there for the patient. So it's not a proper gluten challenge as such, because there's a few other things in there. Whereas a lot of what happens in the trials, and I know this is harder to access, they get challenged with gluten, with actual vital gluten powder, right? Or sometimes you can find it at a supermarket, vital gluten. And sometimes you can even get patients to like microwave it too, because it's like a flour. So we've got to microwave it for health safety reasons, or heat it up, right? And then it can actually be added to things like water, yogurt, and that's pure gluten, right? Now, again, that's a bit tricky. So in the guidelines, we'll be sharing a few tips around that. But I think that's a helpful thing, because it's not to say that's going to hopefully reduce the chances of patients getting extra symptoms too. But there's also some other foods like sourdough spelt bread, for example, right? That spelt will have wheat and it'll have gluten in, but through that production, through making it sourdough, it'll have less FODMAPs in it too, right? So the type of food that we give then is important, right? So that's the first step, I would say. But then we have to look at the amount, right? The amount of gluten. We know in a lot of trials that the amount from a lot of them is kind of something like 3 to 6 grams is probably what we'll recommend in the guidelines. And what I'd say is to give you an idea, right? 3 grams of gluten. I think if you use your hand, there's a portion that's quite good. So it's like a fistful of pasta, maybe, or like a slice of bread, more or less, right? To give you an idea.
That's per day.
So that's 3 grams, right? So what we'd say is if that's 3 grams, then yes, per day, we'd recommend something like 3 to 6, but I'd say even more, because if you think of the test that we're doing with celiac disease, what we're wanting to do is check there's an abnormal response. So the more gluten in the diet, the better. And a lot of times what we try to say, if you can go up to something like 10 grams, then that's probably even better, because a lot of the data really is that amount per day, but also the time, right? The amount of time that we do it on. So I guess the key message really a lot of times is the more gluten for the longer, the better, right? But a lot of patients might struggle with amounts and stuff. So I'd say probably 6 weeks. So you want to do something like, if you want to remember the six grams for 6 weeks, it's probably a good amount to do. If we can push that further, the amount of gluten, great. But if not 6 grams, there's some data for 2 week challenge with higher amounts, like 10 grams potentially. But I don't think we have reassuring data to say that you can guarantee in 2 weeks that person, for example, that person you're telling me, or that potential patient, Pradeep, that if they've gone on a gluten-free diet after their serology was a bit raised until they've had their biopsies in 2 weeks, that they're actually, you're going to see histological changes there. You might not see it with everyone. So I think 6 weeks is something quite good. We can do it a bit longer, fantastic. But the other thing that we need to consider is expectations. So you're asking patients to reintroduce. And as Dave Sanders said, you know, some might say, I'd rather punch you in the face than eat gluten again. So you'll get some patients won't want to do that. So I think managing expectations is a really important part of this. It's saying, you know, some of these symptoms like abdominal pain, nausea, normal, but they tend to settle a bit more when you're eating gluten for a bit longer. So maybe it's bad at the start, but if you keep pushing through, then they might settle a bit more and you might be able to do it, or you might be able to start a graded challenge where you start off with 3 grams and then build it up to 6. And then that's a bit better. So the key thing is keeping them doing the challenge. A lot of patients, if we don't advise them about this, then what they might do is they might just stop it completely rather than just reducing gluten. So if we can keep a lower dose for longer, then that's going to increase the chances of seeing some histological changes or changes with serology. So I think it's these sort of areas. And sometimes as dietitians, you know, what we do is we sort of advise patients on the diet to be able to keep doing eating as much gluten as possible by making some of these little tweaks.
Excellent. So it's not a simple answer, but if you really want to simplify it, the way you're trying to say is 3 to 6 grams, which is probably a slice of toast or 2 slices of toast.
A couple, I'd say, at least. Yeah, a couple of slices of bread for six weeks.
And a handful of pasta for 6 weeks at least. Okay, good. More the better, longer the better in terms of increasing that sensitivity in a way. Okay, Christian, that's good to know why things are not that straightforward, so which is understandable. So let's say you talked about, you know, what advice you give to patients at the beginning, and then you normally would see them after a year, 6 months or so. I'm assuming most patients are compliant with the diet and things. Let's say on the follow-up clinic, normally if I see such patients, I'll say one sentence, yeah, how are you doing? Are you on a gluten-free diet? And they say, yes, doc, no problem whatsoever. Whereas in your setup, in your clinic, I'm sure there's more to it than just, you know, patients might say, but there may be contamination, that this or the other. How do you go about sussing out these other things, that constant ongoing gluten exposure? I think that's more relevant in patients who have ongoing symptoms, right? So how do you go about exploring that?
Yeah, sure. So what we tend to do is we will ask a few more structured questions, and we kind of, from doing it so long, we kind of know what are some common areas to start to ask more about. When we're looking at evaluating adherence, it's important to probably break it down into voluntary and involuntary adherence, right? So sort of voluntary gluten exposure, we can say, is voluntary because the patient will tell you straight off, I'm eating gluten, they know the source, and they're telling you, right, it might be happening this, it might be happening on a weekend, or I struggle socially when I eat out, you know, to be different. So there's a few of these things. And then that's a bit easier, right? So you can kind of catch that a bit easier. But the thing that happens a lot is this involuntary gluten exposure. And that's where patients will tell you, right, I'm following the diet, but there's more to it. And what I'd say is there's different definitions, right? So patients, if they've never had the right support education before, they might think I'm doing a perfect diet because no one's told me I need to avoid cross-contamination. And then I'm just avoiding things from an ingredient point of view. Or I haven't thought about, you know, stuff like sometimes there's a few little extra layers when they eat out, asking about things like shared fryers, for example. So if they're getting foods that might be used in fryers that are used to have like other foods with gluten, for example. So this in the UK, for example, fish and chips, right? Very common to see. So these shared fryers where there's a lot of wheat going into them, if their food is prepared there, then some cross-contamination. There's a few different things, right? But what I'd say is that even from our data that we published, what we showed was that in patients who were putting their hand up and saying, I'm following a gluten-free diet, we identified involuntary sources of gluten exposure in about 40% of them, right? And that goes to show there's a big mismatch between what patients think they're doing with the following the gluten-free diet and what's actually going on. And it's with these things, little things like food labels, they might not be checking everything on a food label. They might not be checking, as we're saying, for cross-contamination or cross-contact on a food label. They might be missing certain ingredients because they're not spotting everything. At home, there might be situations where they're assuming things are fine, and then because they haven't communicated stuff to their family or people at home, then they might be getting involuntary exposure to gluten because other people are doing things like, you know, double dipping with their bread into their spread and these sorts of things. So there's small things in there, I would say. So what we tend to do is ask a few more detailed questions about how patients navigate different scenarios. And it gives us a lot of information about how they navigate that risk and how they set boundaries and avoid gluten or cross-contamination.
So Christian, that 40% is quite a lot, I thought, more than what I would think that patients are not aware that they're being exposed to, and clinicians just assume. And these are probably the patients who will have ongoing symptoms. So you do explore this, tease it out of the patients and give them advice if they've got ongoing symptoms. That brings on to the next question, or maybe the next topic. What is the bare minimum? What is the amount of gluten exposure that is required to cause histological changes, with that causing symptoms to the patients? How low is important, for example?
It's a great question. And I think this is an eye-opener for a lot of patients when we start to tell them and they're not aware of things like cross-contamination, right? So the million-dollar question is, so how much gluten does it actually take to cause me damage in the gut, right? So what I'd say is one of the best studies we've got to date, right, is a study from Carlo Cattassi's group, who's Carlo Cattassi's published a lot of great research in celiac disease back to 2007. So what they did is they gave patients with celiac disease capsules of different amounts of gluten, right? And they were able to see at what stage people start to have more histological changes, symptoms. And what they identified was that 10 to 50 milligrams of gluten was enough to trigger damage in the gut, right? So to give you that in real life terms, 10 milligrams, right? Let's go back to a slice of bread that everyone knows that. So if you get a slice of bread, you chop that into 100 pieces. One of those 100 pieces from that slice of bread is about 10 milligrams, right? So we know that that's going to be too much. And that's why when we talk about celiac disease and the gluten-free diet, and we look at thresholds, when we look at foods that are labeled gluten-free, they have to have way less than that, so that cumulatively people can have a few gluten-free foods in a day and know it's not going to cause damage, right? So that's why the threshold, and this is different in different countries, right? But in the UK and Europe, it's no more than 20 parts per million. That has to be the safe limit. And again, if we go back to the slice of bread to say, a lot of people say, well, 20 parts per million, right? Or 20 milligrams per kilogram, 20 parts per million, what's that? It's a proportion, right? So if we get that same slice of bread, where we've said that one out of those 100 pieces is too much, right? For it to be safe, 20 parts per million would be that same slice, divide it in a million pieces now, and no more than 20 of those can have gluten for that to be safe. So that's way smaller, right? And it's almost like you kind of almost see it on the scale. So it's that tiny. And then when we explain this to patients, it helps them understand, right, cross-contamination or cross-contact, those are the two terms that tend to be used for it, is a thing. And we don't just have to avoid the ingredients. We've got to avoid these scenarios. And it really helps a lot of patients, right, with their symptoms too. That's why a lot of them don't fully respond to the gluten-free diet. There's other causes, which we see, obviously, but it's one of the things that trips them up a lot too. And once they know that and they know how to avoid it, they take some really good steps forward.
Yeah, I think that's where Christian, where let's say the patients come to see a gastroenterologist for follow-up and they have ongoing symptoms, and a simple question of are you following the diet or not is not sufficient. And a formal review by a specialist dietitian is so important if you're saying 40% of those are still being exposed involuntarily.
Definitely.
That's really good to highlight that. And that's really important for gastroenterologists to take home from this conversation.
Yeah, I'd add in too there, Pradeep, the important thing too is that it's safe. So what we showed in our data is that that's saved unnecessary endoscopies too, right? So these patients, if you know, you can't get to the bottom why they're getting symptoms, they're going to end up having a repeat endoscopy. So we were able to identify, and we showed that in the data, that that actually reduced unnecessary endoscopies. We resolved the symptoms quicker, and that's better. And then the patients who, despite that, still have symptoms, then we get them a gastroscopy and we can explore, you know, whatever test they need. So it's a really cost-effective way of managing things, and you get to the root cause of the problem much quicker with that sort of communication and getting that detail from their diet.
Great. That's well explained, Christian. Let's move on to the diagnosis of potential celiac disease. And I covered this with Professor David Sanders earlier. So the guidelines, Prof. Sanders' team defined potential celiac disease as those patients who are positive serology, but they haven't developed the damage within the small bowel, i.e. they don't have villus atrophy. They have very minimal changes. And I guess Prof. Sanders did highlight that, you know, always check why that is, make sure they've taken better biopsies and all that. Yeah, we'll check all that. But he said that these patients, if they are true potential celiac disease patients, these are the ones that are in the waiting room to develop celiac disease. So what would be your advice in the dietary aspects of management for such patients?
Yeah, and I think I'd take a very similar approach to Professor Sanders, because really we know they're in the waiting room potentially, but some of them, you know, a third of them won't develop celiac disease. So I think it's about shared decision making there. And I think it's really about making sure that the patient's got the information they need to make that decision. So what I would say to them is, you know, you could follow a gluten-free diet. Most patients will notice symptom improvement. But I think what we see from a lot of patients is that they feel it's quite a restrictive approach for life. So some of them will come back and say, well, actually, this is too challenging for me to implement without knowing that I have full-blown celiac disease, and I would rather wait. And I think it's really about having a plan that the patient agrees with and a way to come back in if they've got symptoms or issues, and that we, you know, potentially do another endoscopy in some time. But I think there's options there where we can say, if the patient prefers to wait and not change their diet, that's fine. If they want to go on a gluten-free diet, then we'll support them fully to do that. But then there's also these patients are in the middle, which is, I was saying, you know, we have to personalize the diet a bit. And they might say, well, I get symptom relief, but I don't want to fully do it, and I don't want to avoid cross-contamination. And I would argue that that is fine too, because they don't have full-blown celiac disease. We can't see they have villus atrophy. So what we can do is help them that way. If that's as far as they want to go, we continue to monitor them and we see how things evolve. So I think that's why it's really about shared decision-making and trying to personalize it for the patient. And then again, being in line with recommendations from the gastroenterologist, so we're all on the same page. I think that's always completely key.
Yeah. I think as you said, and as Dave said, it's a spectrum. Patients can be in different stages, and the aggressiveness of your approach, if you want to call it that way, would really depend on what process along the patients are, each patient's are individually.
Definitely.
Yeah. Chris, you mentioned about the barley, rye, oat, and wheat. Can you comment on oats and gluten, so to say, a little bit more? Because I thought that was a bit controversial, or maybe that's my understanding.
Yeah, sure. And it isn't just your understanding. It's highly controversial, right? And that's why it'd be good to talk about it a bit more. So basically, oats, right, have been controversial for quite some time in celiac disease, right? So what we've known for some time is that some people with celiac disease will react to oats too, right? And the reason for that is because oats have got a protein that is called avenin, which is quite similar to gluten, right? So some patients will get what we call cross-reactivity, where although oats themselves don't have gluten, right, there is a protein in them that is similar, and some people can be sensitive to them. So that's one problem. But actually, the more common one, which we've seen historically, is that actually, if you think of how oats are milled, how they're harvested, that tends to be with wheat. So a lot of the factories that will produce them and package them, they're packed with wheat, rye, barley too. So there's a lot of what we call cross-contamination. So the biggest challenge in celiac disease really is to make sure that first people with celiac disease, if they eat any oats, that they're always labeled gluten-free oats, right? Because if they're not, they're likely going to have symptoms and problems. And a lot of the early data about oats had oats that were contaminated, right? So that muddies the waters a bit when we're trying to see who's sensitive and who's not. So that's always the first step. And that's what I'd always say. And that's internationally, people with celiac disease, we always want to make sure that either they eat oats, they're actually labeled gluten-free, right? Now, however, what I'd say to this is because of this, the issues with sensitivity and with the gluten-free diet, I said in Europe, the whole 20 parts per million thing is in Europe and the UK, different countries have different approaches, right? So for example, if you look at Australia, Australia does not allow oats at all in the gluten-free diet because of these issues with oats previously. So different countries have different ways of applying the gluten-free diet. But interestingly enough, Australia have actually been really keen to actually explore this issue with oats further and say, actually, do we need to fully avoid them or not? And they actually published the best well-controlled study we've got only last year. Jason Tiedin's group, led by Melinda Hardy, with the publication in 2025 from a team in Australia. And actually what they did is they actually challenged people with gluten-free oats and pure avenin, right? And it was really interesting. It was about 30 patients. And previously we sort of understood that maybe it was about 10% of people with celiac disease that are sensitive to gluten-free oats. But their study showed this is likely closer to something like 3%, right? Again, it was a small study. It's hard to show this, do a long-term data, right? But it's reassuring. And I think a lot of things I would say is from, you know, in my practice, I would recommend patients are okay to have oats as long as they're gluten-free from the start, and we'll monitor them. If there's issues, we can always remove them, take them out. But what I would say is it's already restrictive enough when you take wheat out of the diet. That's an important grain and most patients don't replace it. So actually, I would need a very good reason to remove oats out of someone's diet for life, because actually they're a very good source of soluble fiber. You know, it's got loads of really good nutrients in there for patients. And most of our patients struggle with getting enough fiber in their diet too. So it's that balance between restriction and inclusion. But I think as long as we monitor, there's no one way of doing things, but I think we need to make sure they're always gluten-free and that we monitor patients and give them the right advice and support if we see there's issues with them. Some we might need to take it out of their diet, but we should always explore those symptoms accordingly.
Lovely. Kristen, I think earlier we alluded to the patients in the follow-up clinic that persistent symptoms. And I guess the first thing to explore, or probably most common reason of what we felt, is ongoing involuntary or voluntary gluten exposure, let's call it. What's your approach for such patients if they come to see you in your clinic?
Great question. And I think it's my approach has evolved a lot over time, right? So what I'd always say is the initial thing in someone who's got celiac disease, and actually we look at the data and Sheffield actually have published some fantastic data here because of how the UK is set up, and they're one of the leading centers, right, for non-responsive celiac disease, suspected refractory celiac disease. People send them there. So they actually looked at the causes of non-responsive celiac disease, right? So they published this great paper in 2022. And what they found was that the most common cause is what we were talking about, ongoing gluten ingestion. So about 25% of patients, the main cause is because they're still eating gluten, right? So that's the first thing with celiac disease. We've always got to suspect that. We've got to rule that out first, that are they actually still eating gluten? That's always the first step, right? But interestingly enough, what the second most common cause was IBS or functional type symptoms or DGBIs, right, as we now call them. So really, and that was about 22% of patients. So really at these patients that are coming with persisting symptoms, about half you can sort of resolve them with making sure they're following the diet and supporting them with IBS type advice. A lot of them will have these types of symptoms, but then some of them will have a mix of other conditions, some associated with celiac disease, as we know, microscopic colitis, inflammatory bowel disease, a few full array of things. And some will come back with refractory celiac disease, which we know is extremely rare, right? So that's going to be the most unlikely scenario. So what I'd say is my approach is always that it's really let's tighten everything up with the gluten-free diet, make sure nothing's getting missed, right? But I spot so many of these cases, and I think a lot of this data, you know, that's from previously, but we're getting more and more of this data of DGBIs raising in general, right? I'm sure you see loads of them in clinic pretty compared to previously too. And I think that really a lot of them we get, it's a bit mass because it's a bit of everything. Some, they might not be following the diet as much, but then there's a bit of like this DGBI stuff going on too. So a lot of the advice really is about the gluten-free diet, but also making sure they're eating enough fiber, making sure they're managing stress, getting enough exercise, optimizing sleep. It's like the full package really. And that's what I see really resolve symptoms with people fully. It's that when it's those causes, and then we might need to personalize or tailor the diet because they might have like another medical condition. They've got IBD or something like that. We might need to adapt the diet a bit more to help them in that area.
That's great, Christian. I think we covered most of what I feel that is lacking for a gastroenterologist to understand about the dietary aspects. Is there any other things that we've missed out or anything that you think is relevant to either patients or gastroenterologists in the dietary aspects?
What I'd say is probably that just keeping that emphasis. I know I've talked about it a bit before, but I'd say it's like really the diet, as we've said, the diagnosis is more complex than we often think. So it's really about, I think getting the diagnosis right is such an important thing, right? As Professor Sanders was saying too, you know, doing all the tests you can to elevate the certainty as much as possible, because we're putting someone on a diet for life on this, and it's a restrictive and challenging diet that impacts the patients, their relatives, their friends, family, all of that, right? So I think that's a really important thing. And then it's really not just about what we take out of the diet, it's what we put in. And that's where we've got to really focus on gluten-free grains, getting enough fiber, diversity, getting enough vitamins and minerals. And also that's what reduces the risk of these patients developing more of these disorders of the gut-brain interaction, because they've got a better diet and we already advise them about diet and lifestyle. So it's almost like if we front load the right advice at the start, we set them up for the future self-management. So I think it's really investing in these sorts of things really helps. And then I'd say linked to that, I just feel like, you know, I'm such a big advocate of multidisciplinary working, right? And I know with yourself, I'll always pop you questions, Pradeep, if I've got any questions. You're really good at checking things and getting back. And I think that's such an important thing, that we work closely between dietitians, gastroenterologists, and sometimes even psychologists, because patients can feel really impacted psychologically with many of these things, the symptoms, not coping with the diet. So really where we can work in together, I think is such an important thing in this area too.
Excellent, Christian. I think the thing about what you introduce, because you're taking away quite a lot from these patients. Some patients are already malabsorbing, and then you put them on further restriction, and they might go into more malabsorption rather than curing them.
Yeah. For sure. And it's also for their, you know, what we call food-related quality of life, right? So food impacts people so much. And I think we give them these options, so it helps them getting the nutrients, the right nutrients into their diet. But also many patients feel very frustrated with the diet because they feel it's so limited, but no one's told them what they can eat instead. They've just told them, don't eat this. So I think as clinicians, if we're aware of that, then that's good. And that's what we, part of our work is to get that balance with patients. And then they come back to clinic. This is the interesting thing, right? So many of the patients, even the ones with disorders of the gut-brain interaction, or like say we've got IBS and celiac disease, will come back and like, my symptoms are better, but I'm eating more, I'm enjoying my diet, how is it possible? And it's perfectly possible. We just need the right guidance and support for them.
That's fine, Christian. The one thing I wanted to highlight is, you know, you put out so much out there on your Instagram, the education material, and I'd really strongly suggest people to follow your posts, some amazing posters that you publish. Can you just remind us what your Instagram handle is?
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. So it's on Instagram at celiac_, so celiac with the UK spelling, COE, celiac_dietitian, and dietitian with a D rather than a C, dietitian. And then, yeah, share loads of useful things for, I'm always really keen to support health professionals, patients. So, and anyone, feel free to get in touch if I can help with anything, always more than happy to do it in this space.
Okay. And is there any other resources that clinicians or patients can get to? You mentioned about Celiac UK, but is there anything else in terms of dietary advice, simple things that they can access?
Yeah, so I'd say the ones that I most know are UK ones, right? So I'd say in the UK, there's a website we can link, which is actually Patient Webinars, which are some colleagues who are dietitians down in Somerset who created these resources for patients. And they've got a really good breakdown of celiac disease with a gastroenterologist and dietitian as a recorded webinar. So I think that's a really good one. So that's a helpful one. I've got Celiac UK. There's also, so I've worked with industry to create a resource that's free for clinicians. It's like a 40-page booklet with a lot of helpful resources. You can get it as a PDF, or clinicians can get it sent to the department to give as a printout. So we can link something like that in the show notes. But that's kind of like that scenario you were saying, Pradeep, where we've got 5 minutes in clinic where you can just say, right, there you go, you've got a booklet, right? So you've got that, the Celiac UK, then also with the British Dietetic Association, with some colleagues, we've created a food fact sheet for celiac disease, which again, I can forward that and that can be downloaded. It's like a one pager with just the key things you need to know. But I think with all of those, if we can link them there, then that's some helpful resources. And then, you know, if you're not based in the UK or they're not as helpful, I think always just reaching out to see what's around. I think that's always a good positive thing. And the celiac associations.
Christian, that was lovely. And that was really enlightening, certainly for me. Thanks for coming on today. And thanks from the UEG.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed that.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you've found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues. Enjoyed this episode? You can also find it on Gutflix, the streaming platform for digestive health professionals. Discover expert courses, UEG Week recordings, and podcasts, all personalized to your clinical interests. Visit gutflix.eu and start your GI learning experience.